This podcast is made by and for our internal medicine residents to enhance our educational experience. The content, while vetted by residents, is not personally verified by our hosts or speakers, and we are not content experts in these topics. The content provided in this podcast and in any linked materials is not intended and should not be construed as medical advice and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. We try to stay away from opinions, but all opinions represented are our own and not of the University of Medical Center. Please keep this in mind as you enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
All right, guys, welcome back to the other side of the street. We're back here with Billy to talk about some more of the amazing morning reports. So, Billy, to jump right into it, when we're in our primary care clinics, we do our colon cancer screening age 50 or earlier if something else about their history, usually family history, tells us to. But there are some groups of patients where you're starting to screen with colonoscopies much, much earlier. I heard Audrey gave us a good presentation about that. Can you fill me in?
Yeah, that's right, Eddie. Audrey gave a great presentation about hereditary colon cancer syndromes, particularly a focus on Lynch syndrome. And I mean, I think that the first thing that we need to highlight is, just as you said, is that colon cancer is very common. You know, there are 140, 150,000 new cases diagnosed every year, and about 50 or 60,000 people a year will die from colon cancer. And we also know, and the reason we do our colonoscopies is that early detection at stage one denotes a tremendous survival benefit for patients at stage one, survive about 92% to 5 years, as opposed to those who are diagnosed later in their course have a much lower survival rate, actually down as low as 12 to 20%. And so, you know, our normal patient population aside, there are about 15% of colon cancers that can be attributed to what's called microsatellite instability. And microsatellite instability basically refers to the inability of the DNA in the colonic mucosa to repair itself. Another way of talking about these enzymes are the DNA mismatch repair genes. And there are a number of these. And specifically, there are a couple that are passed on in an autosomal dominant pattern. These are the MLH1, MSH2, MSH6, etc. And they are the ones that are associated with Lynch syndrome. And you know, the nomenclature around Lynch syndrome is pretty interesting. And Audrey actually mentioned that Dr. Lynch himself was the one who coined the term HNPCC, or hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancer, of course, to differentiate it from FAP, which is familial adenomatous polyposis. And it was other scientists and other clinicians who said colon cancer is not the only piece of the pie here. There are other cancers associated with these mismatch repair genes, specifically ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, even renal and stomach cancer. And so while Dr. Lynch himself described HNPCC, others have said, no, you know, your discovery is associated with more than just colon cancer. And so Audrey highlighted that now it's actually more correct to say Lynch syndrome if you're worried about a familial inheritance pattern. And you know, it really is important to screen these patients early. You know, you start screening around the age of 20 or 25, you're going to have a strong family history here. Again, this is an autosomal dominant inheritance pattern. And when you think about screening, you know, don't just have sort of early screening at 20 to 25 in your mind. You should be thinking 10 years earlier than the earliest diagnosis in the family. And this is also true for our standard patient population, where if you have a patient whose, you know, mother was diagnosed at age 50, you're going to start screening that patient at age 40. And I think that one of the most important and interesting things that Audrey talked about in her presentation is it's important to identify these people not only because of screening, but actually we can prevent a number of their cancers. So she talked about a study called the CAPP2 study, that's CAPP2, or the Colorectal Adenoma Carcinoma Prevention Program. And this was a population of about 860 patients with Lynch syndrome and was testing aspirin to see if aspirin could reduce the development of neoplasia, specifically in the colon, where these patients get cancer. Multiple centers, 16 countries. Patients were followed for about 5 years, half and half assigned to aspirin and placebo. And there were only 48 cases of colorectal cancer in the 860 patients. But if you look at the two groups, patients who were given at least 2 years of aspirin, now this is a higher dose than traditionally given, it's 600 milligrams, but patients who had at least 2 years of aspirin had a hazard ratio of 0.4 as compared to their controls. As we always think about with anticoagulants, you know, there was really no difference in adverse events. And also noted in the study is that for patients who did get colon cancer, there was no difference between the staging or location, or say, for example, patients who took aspirin who got colon cancer had, say, a less invasive stage. That was not the case. And since the CAP2 study was published and showed this significant risk, currently the same group is looking at if there is a difference in the doses of aspirin. Say, for example, could you just give a standard 325 and reduce the risk of cancer in this population? So, you know, just to sort of bring everything home, always ask about family history of colon cancer. You may catch one of these familial syndromes. If that is the case, you need to screen early and often. And it just so happens that you think a patient might have either HNPCC or more properly, Lynch syndrome, you need to think about putting these patients on prophylactic aspirin.
So Billy, when I'm on the wards, I know one of the bane of my social work existence is trying to arrange for long-term IV antibiotics. And this usually happens in patients who have endocarditis. I heard that Steph gave a good presentation talking about a really recent study that says maybe we don't need to give the full course of IV antibiotics. Can you fill me in?
Yeah, that's right. Steph gave a great morning report, actually on a very recent journal article in the New England Journal. The title of the article is Partial Oral versus Intravenous Antibiotic Treatment of Endocarditis. The acronym it's been named by is the POET trial, P-O-E-T. Specifically wanting to answer this question, you know, can we get away with oral antibiotics after patients have been clinically stable in the hospital on IV antibiotics? And this was a randomized multicenter trial. It was, it's important to recognize, a non-inferiority study. They were comparing oral regimens, making sure they were non-inferior to the standard six-week course of intravenous antibiotics. And the primary outcomes here were mortality and unplanned cardiac surgery, say, for example, if there was a deterioration in a valve, further embolic events, or patients who had relapsed bacteremia. And the idea here was to stabilize people in the hospital. And I think in their results, it was about an average of 2 weeks or a little over 2 weeks that people actually ended up staying in the hospital on IV antibiotics before half of the population was transitioned. And they followed these patients for 6 months to follow all of these outcomes. I think it's important to know a few things about the population that they selected. First off, it was about 400 patients. So we had 200 patients in each arm. This was an older population. The average age was about 67 years in both groups. It was about half and half, women and men. They, in general, did not have a whole lot of comorbid illness. So, for example, only 18% of the patients in the IV group and 15 in the oral group had diabetes. So low rates of a lot of the complications we see in the hospital. And also, notably, there were only 5 patients in the study who had a history of intravenous drug use. So when we're talking about the results and the outcomes with this study, just keep in mind that this was a population that did not have a significant amount of comorbidities, that were not IV drug users, and that were older and potentially more stable in terms of their socioeconomic situation, although I admit that that's an extrapolation. All right, so after these patients were randomized, there are a couple things to note about their treatment. So first off is that each patient was on 2 oral antibiotics, and they were followed very closely. They were followed 2 to 3 times per week while they were on their oral regimens, and then monthly out to that 6-month mark that I mentioned earlier. Patients, in order to be randomized into this trial, you know, could not have had any arrhythmias or concern for a decline in mental status to exclude patients who would not be able to follow up with this pretty strict follow-up regimen, as well as take their antibiotics as prescribed. And, you know, they gave examples in their supplement of all of the different antibiotic regimens that they chose for the specific bacteria that were isolated in each patient. And, you know, Steph gave us one of the examples. For patients with enterococcal bacteremia, there were 4 different regimens that the study personnel could have chosen. And 2 of them were amoxicillin with rifampicin or amoxicillin with moxifloxacin. And then you could do either the rifampicin or moxifloxacin with linezolid. And so the bioavailability of these drugs was excellent. They were targeted based on, like I said, organism and susceptibility and were followed very, very closely. In terms of their outcomes, I'll just come out and say it. The oral arm was non-inferior to the intravenous arm. As you might expect, there were certainly less complications in the patients who took oral antibiotics as opposed to those who had 6 weeks of a PICC line. There also was, they estimated to be, a significant reduced cost in the patients who were on oral antibiotics. But they were smart in recognizing the limitations of their study. The patients had to be highly reliable. They had to have the ability to get to appointments up to 3 times per week. And I think that what that does for us is, while oral antibiotics were non-inferior to IV antibiotics, we really need to take into consideration that this was a very selective population who were A, not very sick with other comorbid conditions, and B, had a tremendous ability and resources to follow up. And so while I don't think this is really going to move the needle on our standard of care, I think it's good to know that it's out there. I think it's good to know that maybe once in the next couple of years, you might turn to this study and ask if your patient might qualify. So I wouldn't go necessarily changing your approach to all your patients with infective endocarditis just yet.
So JP, I feel like as a resident, one of the tests that I always know to order, but don't really know exactly what to do with all the time, is the ANCA. But I heard Thomas gave us a great presentation explaining to us that knowing what to do with that test might be actually the most important part of it. Can you fill me in a little bit on that?
I can. He did. Thomas gave us a great presentation on ANCA-associated vasculitides, not only on the clinical presentation, but how we test for them and how we diagnose them. He talked about the 3 common ANCA-associated vasculitides, or microscopic polyangiitis, granulomatosis with polyangiitis, formerly known as Wegener's, and eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis, formerly known as Churg-Strauss. So the presentation is relatively similar for all 3. Common features: fevers, fatigue, weight loss, arthritis or arthralgia, elevated ESR, thrombocytosis, anemia, chronic disease, if this has been progressive and sort of smoldering for a while. Specific features to these vasculitides: palpebral purpura, mononeuritis multiplex, which is the dysfunction of a peripheral nerve in different locations in the body, as well as hemoptysis and hematuria. He discussed some of the pathogenesis of ANCA, and I'm not going to go too much into the immunologic consequences of neutrophil activation, but suffice it to say that ANCA is the end effect of neutrophils actively degranulating, which in turn increases endothelial cell activation, leads to complement activation and cell apoptosis. Here's where we get into the interesting part. He discussed ANCA testing, and with ANCA testing, you have 2 sets, the immunofluorescence antibodies and the ELISA antibodies. Immunofluorescence antibodies are commonly known as the P-ANCA and the C-ANCA. The P stands for perinuclear and the C for cytoplasmic. And essentially, these antibodies are recognized particular epitopes that are unknown to us that are present in the neutrophils, either in the perinuclear area around the neutrophils or in the cytoplasm of the neutrophils. This is evaluated by a human being looking down a microscope and seeing how much these cells glow and where they glow. Subtext, very nonspecific. Somebody is saying that the cells are glowing. Always be cautious. The ELISA is more of a standardized test where the ELISA is actually measuring the reaction or the presence of antibodies to 2 epitopes, in this case, PR3 and MPO. The combination of the immunofluorescence positivity together with ELISA positivity is what helps us and guides us in terms of diagnosing our ANCA vasculitides. And the combination of either or can help us decide between one of these 3 options. The general take home is that in granulomatosis with polyangiitis, 60 to 90% of patients are ANCA positive, and more than 80% of patients are going to be PR3 positive. So that means positive immunofluorescence for ANCA together with positive ELISA for PR3. In microscopic polyangiitis, nearly 90% of patients are going to be ANCA positive, and most are going to have MPO ELISA positivity. And in EGPA, eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis, ANCA positivity is now going to go from 30% to 70%, and there's going to be variable PR3 and MPO. So as you can see, or hear, in all of these tests, there's some fudge factor. They are not 100% specific and sensitive. He mentioned one particular publication. They tested both immunofluorescence and ELISAs on 856 consecutive patients with possible ANCA-associated conditions, and the take-home message was that the positive predictive value of a positive ELISA with a positive PR3 or MPO, was around 88%. What does this tell us? In this particular context, it's somewhat limited. These patients were highly subselected. We don't know why they got ANCA testing in the first place, and they may have or may not have had active disease. But the bottom line is, together with our clinical diagnosis, so if we're ordering this in the right population, so not across the board, but in people that we think have an ANCA vasculitis, and ELISA has a very high positive predictive value and a positive likelihood ratio. However, keep in mind, negative testing does not rule this out. He included a great quote towards the end of his presentation, and I'll read it out. Nevertheless, because of the significant number of ANCA-positive patients who meet the current guidelines for these conditions, the diagnosis of these conditions remains, in the final analysis, a clinical pathological one. So take home, you need to consider what tests you're ordering for these particular patients, take their clinical presentation into account, and make sure that you're interpreting both the immunofluorescence and the ELISA results when you're concerned about diagnosing an ANCA vasculitis.